Side 3. Eidoru by William Gibson. Continuing on page 99. Yes, Hiromi Ogawa said.
You are welcome.
And now, Tomo Oshima, our chapter's historian, will favor us with a detailed and accurate account of our chapter's story. How we came from simple but sincere beginning to be the most active, the most respectful chapter in Japan today.
Chia couldn't believe it.
The girl nearest Hiromi, on Chia's right, bowed and began to recite the chapter's history in what Chia immediately understood would be the most excruciatingly boring detail. The two boarding school roommates, best friends and the most loyal of buddies, who discovered a copy of the Dog Soup album in a bin in Akihabara. How they returned to school with it, played it, were immediate converts. How their schoolmates mocked them, at one point even stealing and hiding the precious recording. And on, and she already felt like screaming, but there was nothing for it but to sit there. She pulled up a clock and stuck it on the mirrored robot's face, where the eyes should have been. Nobody else could see it, but it made her feel a little better. Now they were into the first Japanese national low-res convention, snapshots flashing on the white paper walls, little girls in jeans and t-shirts drinking Coca-Cola in some function room in an Osaka airport hotel, a few obvious parents standing around in the background. 45 minutes later, by the red readout stuck to Hiromi Ogawa's blank metallic face, Tomo Oshima concluded,
"Which brings us to the present, and the historic visit of Chia McKenzie, the representative of our sister chapter in Seattle in the state of Washington. And now I hope that she will honor us by recounting the history of her own chapter, how it was founded, and the many activities it has undertaken to honor the music of low-res."
There was a soft burst of applause. Chia didn't join in, uncertain whether it was for her or for Tomo Oshima.
"Sorry," Chia said. "Our historian put all that together for you, but it got corrupted when they ran my computer through that big scanner at the airport."
"We are very sorry to hear that," the silver robot said.
"How unfortunate."
"Yeah," Chia said.
"But I guess it gives us more time to discuss what brings me here, right? We had hoped to help us understand this whole res thing, right? We know. We're glad you do. Because we're all really worried about this rumor. Because it seems like it started here. And this Rei Towei is a local product. So if anybody can tell us what's going on, it's you."
The silver robot said nothing. It was expressionless as ever. But Chia took the clock away, just to be sure.
"That's why I'm here," Chia said. "To find out if it's true he wants to marry her."
She sensed a general uneasiness. The six girls were looking at the texture-mapped tatami, unwilling to meet her eyes. She wanted to look at Mitsuko, but it would have been too obvious.
"We are an official chapter," Hiromi said. "We have the honor of working closely with actual employees of the band. Their publicists are also concerned with the rumor you mentioned, and they have requested that we assist them in seeing that it is not spread further."
"Spread? It's been on the net for a week."
"It is rumor only."
"Then they should issue a denial."
"Denial would add weight to the rumor. The posting said that Rez had announced that he was in love with Rei Towei, that he was going to marry her. There was a long quote."
Chia was definitely starting to get the feeling that something was wrong here. This was not what she'd come all this physical distance for. She might as well have been sitting in her bedroom in Seattle.
"We think that the original posting was a hoax. It would not be the first."
"You think?
Doesn't that mean you don't know?"
"Our sources within the organization assure us there is no cause for concern."
"Spin control," Chia said.
"You imply that low-res employees are lying to us?"
"Look," Chia said, "I'm as into the band as anybody. I came all this way, right? But the people who work for them are just people who work for them. If Rez gets up in a club one night, takes the mic and announces that he's in love with this Eidoru and swears he's going to marry her, PR people are going to say whatever they think they have to say."
"But you have no evidence that any of this occurred. Only an anonymous posting, claiming to be a transcription of a recording made in a club in Shinjuku."
"Monkey boxing. We looked it up. It's there."
"Really?
Perhaps you should go there."
"Why?" "There is no longer a club called Monkey Boxing."
"There isn't. Clubs in Shinjuku are extremely short-lived. There is no Monkey Boxing."
All of Hiromi's smug satisfaction came through in the sandbender's translation. Chia stared at the smooth, silver face.
stonewalling bitch. What to do? What would Zona Rosa do if she were in Chia's place? Something symbolically violent, Chia decided, but that wasn't her style.
Thank you, Chia said. We just wanted to make sure it wasn't happening. Sorry I hit on you that way, but we had to be certain. If you say it's not happening, we'll accept that. We all care about Rez and the rest of the band, and we know you do too.
Chia added a bow of her own, one that seemed to take Hiromi off guard. Now it was the robot's turn to hesitate. She hadn't expected Chia to just roll over that way.
Our friends in the low-res organization are very concerned that this pointless hoax not affect the public's perception of Rez. You are aware that there has always been a tendency to portray him as the most creative, but least stable member of the band.
This last, at least, was true, though Rez's style of instability was fairly mild compared with most of his pop cultural forebears. He had never been arrested, never spent a night in jail. But he was still the one most likely to get into trouble. It had always been part of his charm.
Sure, Chia said, playing along, relishing the uncertainty she was sure she was causing Hiromi. And they try to make Lo out as some kind of boring techie, the practical one. But we know that isn't true either.
She tagged it with a smile.
Yes, Hiromi said, of course. But you are satisfied then? You will explain to your chapter that this was all the result of some prank? And that all is well with Rez? If you say so, Chia said. Absolutely. And if that settles it, then I've got 3 more days to kill in Japan.
To kill.
Idiom, Chia said. Free time. Mitsuko says I ought to see Kyoto.
Kyoto is very beautiful.
I'm on my way, Chia said. Thanks for putting the site together for our meeting. It's really great. And if you'll save it, I'd love to access it later with the rest of my chapter. Maybe we could all get together here when I'm back in Seattle. Introduce our chapters.
Yes. Hiromi definitely didn't know what to make of Chia's attitude. So worry about it, Chia thought.
You knew, Chia said. You knew she'd do that.
Mitsuko was blushing bright red, looking at the floor, her jelly bag computer on her lap.
I am sorry. It was her decision. They got to her, right? They told her to get rid of me, hush it up. She communicates with the low-res people privately. It is one of the privileges of her position.
Chia still had her tip sets on.
I have to talk with my chapter now. Can you give me a few minutes alone?
She felt sorry for Mitsuko, but she was still angry.
I'm not angry with you, okay?
I will make tea, Mitsuko said.
When Mitsuko had closed the door behind her, Chia checked that the sandbenders was still ported, put the goggles back on, and selected the Seattle chapter's main site.
She never got there.
Zona Rosa was waiting to cut her out. 15. Akihabara. Low gray cloud pressing down on the sheer gray city. A glimpse of new buildings through the scaled-down limo's tinted, lace-curtained windows. They passed an Apple Shires ad, a cobbled lane leading away into some hologram nursery land where smiling juice bottles danced and sang. Lainey's jet lag was back, in some milder but more baroque format, something compounded of a pervasive sense of guilt and a feeling of physical distance from his own body, as though the sensory signals arrived stale, after too long a passage, through some other country that he himself was never privy to.
I thought we'd done with all of that when we got rid of those Siberian neuropeds, Blackwell said.
He was dressed entirely in black, which had the effect of somewhat reducing his bulk. He wore a soft, smock-like garment sewn from very black denim, multiple pockets around its wide hem. Lainey thought it looked vaguely Japanese, in some medieval way, something a carpenter might wear.
Bent as a dog's hind legs. Picked them up touring the Combinat States.
Neuropad?
Filling Rez's head with their garbage. He's vulnerable to influences, touring. Combination of stress and boredom. Cities start to look the same. One hotel room after another. It's a syndrome is what it is.
Where are we going?
Akihabara.
Where?
Where we're going.
Blackwell consulted an enormous, elaborately dialed, steel-braceleted chronometer that looked as though it had been designed to do double duty as brass knuckles.
Took a month before they let me ever go, do what was needed. Then we got him over to a clinic in Paris, and they told us what those bastards had been feeding him, had made a pig's breakfast of his endocrine system. Put him right in the end, but it needn't have happened. None of it.
But you got rid of him? Lainey had no idea what Blackwell was talking about, but it seemed best to keep up the illusion of conversation.
Told them I was thinking about putting them face first through a little Honda tree shredder I'd purchased. Just on the off chance, Blackwell said. Not necessary. Showed them it, though. In the end, they were sent along with no more than a moderate touch-up.
Lainey looked at the back of the driver's head. The right-hand drive worried him. He felt like there was nobody in the driver's seat. How long did you say you'd worked for the band?
5 years.
Lainey thought of the video. Blackwell's voice in the darkened club. 2 years ago. Where are we going?
Be there soon enough. They entered an area of narrower streets, of featureless, vaguely shabby buildings covered with unlit, inactivated advertising,
huge representations of media platforms Lainey didn't recognize. Some of the buildings revealed what he assumed was quake damage. Head-sized gobs of a brownish, glass-like substance protruded from cracks that ran diagonally across one facade, like a cheap toy repaired badly by a clumsy giant. The limo pulled to the curb.
Electric tan, Blackwell said.
I'll page you, he said to the driver, who nodded in a way that struck Lainey as being not particularly Japanese. Blackwell opened the door and got out with that same unlikely grace Lainey had noted before, the car bucking noticeably with the departure of his weight. Lainey, sliding across the gray velour seat, felt tired and wooden. Somehow, I was expecting a more upscale destination, he said to Blackwell. It was true.
Stop expecting, Blackwell said.
The building with the cracks and the brown sap-like knobs opened into a white and pastel sea of kitchen appliances. The ceiling was low, laced with temporary-looking pipes and conduits. Lainey followed Blackwell down a central aisle. A few figures stood along other aisles to either side, but he had no way of knowing whether these were salespeople or potential customers. An old-fashioned escalator was grinding away at the end of the central aisle, the rectilinear steel teeth at the edges of each ascending step worn sharp and bright. Blackwell kept walking, levitated ahead of Lainey, climbing, his feet barely seeming to move. Lainey mounted hard behind him. They rose up to a second level, this one displaying a less consistent range of goods. Wall screens, immersion consoles, automated recliners with massage modules bulging from their cushions like the heads of giant mechanical grubs. Along an aisle walled with corrugated plastic cartons, Blackwell with his scarred hands tucked deep in the pockets of his ninja smock. Into a maze of bright blue plastic tarps slung from pipes overhead. Unfamiliar tools. A worker's dented thermos standing on a red tool kit that spanned a pair of aluminum sawhorses. Blackwell holding a final tarp aside, Lainey ducked, entering.
We've been holding it open for the past hour, Blackwell, someone said. Not an easy thing.
Blackwell let the tarp fall into place behind him.
Had to collect him from the hotel.
The space, walled off with the blue tarps on three sides, was twice the size of Lainey's hotel room, but considerably more crowded. A lot of hardware was assembled there. A collection of black consoles were cabled together in a white swamp of styrofoam packing form, torn corrugated plastic, and crumpled sheets of bubble pack. Two men and a woman, waiting. It was the woman who had spoken. As Lainey shuffled forward, ankle deep through the packing materials, the stuff creaked and popped, slippery under the soles of his shoes. Blackwell kicked at it.
You might have tidied up.
We aren't set dressers, the woman said. She sounded Lainey as though she was from Northern California. She had short brown hair cut in bangs, and something about her reminded him of the Quants who worked at Slitscan. Like the other two, men, one Japanese and one red-haired, she wore jeans and a generic nylon bomber jacket.
Hell of a job on short notice, the redhead said.
No notice, the other corrected. and he was definitely from California. His hair was pulled straight back, fastened high in a little samurai ponytail.
What you paid for?
Blackwell said.
We're paid to tour, the redhead said. If you want to tour again, you'd better hope that these work.
Blackwell looked at the cabled consoles. Laney saw a folding plastic table set up against the rear wall. It was bright pink. There was a gray computer there, a pair of iPhones. Unfamiliar cables ran to the nearest console. Flat ribbons, candy-striped in different colors. The wall behind was plastered with an overlay of old advertising. A woman's eye was directly behind the pink table, a yard wide, her laser-printed pupil the size of Laney's head. Laney moved toward the table, through the styrofoam, sliding his feet, a motion not unlike cross-country skiing.
Let's do it, he said. Let's see what you've got.
16. Zona. Zona Rosa kept a secret place, a country carved from what once had been a corporate website. It was a valley lined with ruined swimming pools, overgrown with cactus and red Christmas flowers. Lizards posed like hieroglyphs on mosaics of shattered tile. No houses stood in that valley, though sections of broken wall gave shade, or rusting rectangles of corrugated metal set aslant on weathered wooden uprights. Sometimes there were ashes of a cooking fire. She kept it early evening there.
Zona, someone is trying to find you.
Zona in a ragged leather jacket over a white t-shirt. In that place, she presented as a quick collage, fragments torn from films, magazines, Mexican newspapers, dark eyes, Aztec cheekbones, a dusting of acne scars, her black hair tangled like smoke. She kept the resolution down. Never let herself come entirely into focus.
My mother? No, someone with resources. Someone who knows that you're in Tokyo.
The narrow toes of her black boots were pale with the dust of the valley. There were copper zips down the outer seams of her faded black jeans, waist to ankle.
Why are you dressed that way?
Gia remembered that she was still presenting in the Silke Marie Kolb outfit.
There was a meeting. Very formal. Major butt pain. I got this with Kelsey's cash card. Where were you ported? When you paid for it?
Where I'm ported now? Mitsuko's place?
Zona frowned.
What other purchases have you made?
None.
Nothing?
A subway ticket?
Zona snapped her fingers and a lizard scurried from beneath a rock. It ran up her leg and into her waiting hand. As she stroked it with the fingers of the other hand, the patterns of its coloration changed. She tapped its head, and the lizard ran down her leg, vanishing behind a crumpled sheet of rusted roofing.
Kelsey is frightened. Frightened enough to come to me.
Frightened of what?
Someone contacted her about your ticket. They were trying to reach her father because the points used to purchase it were his. But he is traveling. They spoke with Kelsey instead. I think they threatened her.
With what?
I don't know. But she gave them your name and the number of the cash card.
Chia thought about Mary Alice and Eddie. Zona Rosa took a knife from her jacket pocket and squatted on a shelf of pinkish rock. Golden dragons swirled in the shallow depths of the knife's pink plastic handle. She thumbed a button of plated tin, and the dragon-etched blade snapped out, its spine sawtoothed and merciless.
She has no balls, your Kelsey.
She's not my Kelsey, Zona.
Zona picked up a length of green-barked branch and began to shave thin curls from it with the edge of the switchblade.
She would not last an hour in my world.
On a previous visit, she'd told Kelsey stories of the war with the rats, pitched battles fought through the garbage-strewn playgrounds and collapsing parking garages of vast housing projects. How had that war begun? Over what? Zona never said.
Neither would I. So who is looking for you?
My mother would be if she knew I was here.
That was not your mother, the one who put the fear into Kelsey.
If someone knew my seat number on the flight over, they could get a ticket number and trace it back, right?
If they had certain resources, yes. It would be illegal.
From there, they could go to Kelsey.
From there, they are in the frequent flyer miles of Air Magellan, which implies very serious resources.
There was a woman on the plane. She had the seat beside me. Then I had to carry your suitcase, and she and her boyfriend gave me a ride into Tokyo.
You carried her suitcase?
Yes.
Tell me the story, all of it. When did you first see this woman?
In the airport, SeaTac. They were doing non-invasive DNA samples, and I saw her do this weird thing.
Shea began the story of Mary Alice and the rest of it, while Zona Rosa sat and peeled and sharpened her stick, frowning.
Fuck your mother,
Zona Rosa said, when Shea had finished her story. The translation rendered her tone as either amazement or disgust. Shea couldn't tell.
What?
Shea's confusion was absolute. Zona looked at her along the length of the peeled stick.
An idiom. Idioma. Very rich and complicated. It has nothing to do with your mother.
She lowered the stick and did something to her knife, folding the blade away with a triple click. The lizard she'd adjusted earlier came scurrying low across a narrow ledge of rock, clinging so close as to appear two-dimensional. Zona picked it up and stroked it into yet another color configuration.
What are you doing?
Harder encryption,
Zona said, and put the lizard on the lapel of her jacket, where it clung like a brooch, its eyes tiny spheres of onyx.
Someone is looking for you. Probably they've already found you. We must try to ensure that our conversation is secure.
Can you do that with him?
The lizard's head moved.
Maybe. He's new.
But those are better.
She pointed up with the stick. Shea squinted into the evening sky. Dark cloud, tinted with streaks of sunset pink. She thought she saw a sweep of wings, so high. Two things flying. Big. Not planes. But then they were gone.
Illegal in your country. Colombian, from the data havens.
Zona put the pointed end of her stick on the ground and began to twirl it one way, then the other between her palms. Shea had seen a rabbit make fire that way once in an ancient cartoon.
You are an idiot.
Why?
You carried a bag through customs? A stranger's bag?
Yes.
Idiot! I am not. She is a smuggler. You are hopelessly naive.
But you went along with sending me here, Shea thought, and suddenly felt like crying.
But why are they looking for me?
Zona shrugged.
In the district, a cautious smuggler would not let a mule go free.
Something silvery and cold executed a tight little flip somewhere behind and below Chia's navel, and with it came the unwelcome recollection of the washroom at Whiskey Clone and the corner of something she hadn't recognized. In her bag, stuffed down between her t-shirts, when she'd used one to dry her hands.
What's wrong? I better go. Mitsuko went to make tea.
Talking too quickly, biting off the words.
Go? Are you insane? We must...
Sorry. Bye.
Pulling off the goggles and scrabbling at the wrist fasteners. Her bag there, where she'd left it. XVII. The Walls of Fame.
We had no time to do this right,
the woman said, handing Lainey the iPhones. He was sitting on a child-sized pink plastic bench that matched the table.
If there is a way to do it right...
There are areas we could not arrange access to, said the Japanese-American with the ponytail. Blackwell said you've had experience with celebrities,
actors, Lainey said, musicians, politicians.
You probably find this different, bigger, by a couple of degrees of magnitude.
What can't you access?
Lainey asked, settling the phones over his eyes.
We don't know, he heard the woman say. You'll get a sense of the scale of things going in. The blanks might be accountancy, tax law stuff, contracts. We're just tech support. He has other people. Someone pays to make sure parts of it stay as private as possible.
Then why not bring them in?
Lainey asked. He felt Blackwell's hand come down on his shoulder like a bag of sand.
I'll discuss that with you later. Now get in there and have a look. What we pay you for, isn't it?
In the week following Allison Shire's death, Lainey had used out-of-control's Datamerica account to re-access the site of her personal data. The nodal point was gone, and a certain subtle reduction had taken place,
Not a shrinkage, so much as a tidying, a folding in. But the biggest difference was simply that she was no longer generating data. There was no credit activity. Even her Upfull Groupvine account had been canceled. As her estate was executed and various business affairs terminated, her data began to take on a neat rectilinearity. Lainey thought of the dead bundled squarely in their grave clothes, of coffins and cairns, of the long straight avenues of cemeteries in the days when the dead had been afforded their own real estate. The nodal point had formed where she had lived. While she had lived, in the messy, constantly proliferating interface with the ordinary, yet endlessly multiplex world. Now there was no longer an interface. He'd looked, but only briefly and very cautiously, to see whether her actor might be undertaking tidying activities of his own. Nothing obvious there, but he imagined Out of Control would have set a more careful watch on that. Her data was very still. Only a faint, methodical movement at its core. Something to do with the ongoing legal mechanism of the execution of her estate. A catalog of each piece of furniture in the bedroom of a guest house in Ireland. A subcatalog of the products provided in the 17th century walnut commode at bedside there. Toothbrush, toothpaste, analgesic tablets, tampons, razor, shaving gel. Someone would check these periodically, restock to the inventory. The last guest had taken the gel, but not the razor. In the first catalog, there was a powerful pair of Austrian binoculars, tripod-mounted, which also functioned as a digital camera. Lainey accessed its memory, discovering that the recording function had been used exactly once on the day the manufacturer's warranty had been activated. The warranty was now 2 months void. The single recorded image, a view from a white-curtained balcony, looking toward what Lainey took to be the Irish Sea. There was an unlikely palm tree, a length of chain-link fence, a rail bed with a twin, dull gleam of track, a deep expanse of grayish-brown beach, and then the gray and silver sea. Closer to the sea, partially cut off by the image's border, there appeared to be a low, broad fort of stone, like a truncated tower. Its stones were the color of the beach. Lainey tried to quit the bedroom, the guest house, and found himself surrounded by archaeologically precise records of the restoration of 5 vast ceramic stoves in an apartment in Stockholm. These were like giant chess pieces, towers of brick faced with elaborately glazed, lavishly molded ceramic. They rose to the 14-foot ceilings, and several people could easily have stood upright in one. There was a record of the numbering, disassembly, cleaning, restoration, and reassembly of each brick in each stove. There was no way to access the rest of the apartment. But the proportions of the stoves led Lainey to assume that it was very large. He clicked to the end of the stove record and noted the final price of the work. At current rates, it was more than several times his former annual salary at Slitscan. He clicked back through points of recession, trying for a wider view, a sense of form, but there were only walls, bulking masses of meticulously arranged information. And he remembered Alison Shires, and his apprehension of her data death. The lights are on, Lainey said, removing the iPhones. But there's nobody home. He checked the computer's clock. He'd spent a little over 20 minutes in there. Blackwell regarded him dourly. Settled on an injection-molded crate like a black-draped Buddha, the scars in his eyebrows knitted into new configurations of concern. The 3 technicians looked carefully blank, hands in the pockets of their matching jackets. "How's that, then?" Blackwell asked. "I'm not sure," Lainey said. "He doesn't seem to do anything."
"He doesn't bloody do anything but do things," Blackwell declared. "As you'd know if you were orchestrating his bloody security."
"Okay," Lainey said. "Then where do you have breakfast?" Blackwell looked uncomfortable.
"In his suite?"
"His suite where?"
"Imperial Hotel."
Blackwell glared at the technician. "Which empire, exactly?"
"Here, bloody Tokyo."
"Here? He's in Tokyo?"
"You lot," Blackwell said. "Outside."
The brown-haired woman shrugged inside her nylon jacket and went kicking through the styrofoam head down, the other two following in her wake. When the tarp dropped behind them, Blackwell rose from his crate.
don't think you can try me on for size.
I'm telling you that I don't think this is going to work. Your man isn't in there.
That's his bloody life.
How did he pay for his breakfast?
Signed to the suite.
Is the suite in his name?
Of course not.
Say he needs to buy something during the course of the day.
Someone buys it for him, don't they?
And pays with?
A card.
But not in his name.
Right.
So if anyone were looking at the transaction data, there'd be no way to connect it directly to him, would there? No? Because you're doing your job, right?
Yes.
Then he's invisible. To me. I can't see him. He isn't there. I can't do what you want to pay me to do. It's impossible.
But what about all the rest of it?
Laney put the iPhones down on the keyboard.
That isn't a person. That's a corporation. But you've got it all. His bloody houses, his flats, where the gardeners put the bloody flowers in the rock wall. All of it.
But I don't know who he is. I can't make him out against the rest of it. He's not leaving the traces that make the patterns I need. Blackwell sucked in his upper lip and kept it there.
Laney heard the dislodged prosthesis click against his teeth.
I have to get some idea of who he really is, Laney said. The lip reemerged, damp and gleaming.
Christ, Blackwell said. That's a poser.
I have to meet him. Blackwell wiped his mouth with the back of his hand.
His music, then?
He raised his eyebrows, hopefully.
Oh, there's video.
I've got video, thanks. It really might help if I could meet him. Blackwell touched his ear stump.
You meet him. You think you'll be able to get his do that thing Yammer's on about?
I don't know, Laney said. I can try.
Bloody hell, Blackwell said.
He plowed through the styrofoam, swept the tarp aside with his arm, barked for the waiting technicians, then turned back to Laney.
Sometimes I'd as soon be back with my mate in Jika Jika. Get things sorted in there. They bloody stay that way.
The woman with the brown bangs thrust her head in, pat the edge of the tarp.
Collect his business in the van,
Blackwell told her.
Have it ready to use when we need it.
We don't have a van, Keithy,
the woman said.
Buy one,
Blackwell said. 18. The Otaku. Something rectangular, yielding to the first touch, but hard inside as she tugged it free. Wrapped in a blue and yellow plastic bag from the SeaTac Duty Free, crookedly sealed with wrinkled lengths of slick brown tape. Heavy. Compact.
Hello.
Chia very nearly falling backward, where she crouched above her open bag at the voice and the sight of this boy, who in that first instant she takes to be an older girl, side-parted hair falling past her shoulders.
I am Masahiko.
No translator. He wore a dark, oversized tunic, vaguely military, buttoned to its high banded collar, loose around his neck. Old gray sweatpants bagging at the knees. Grubby-looking white paper slippers.
Mitsuko made tea,
indicating the tray, the stoneware pot, two cups. But you were ported.
Is she here?
Chia pushed the thing back down into her bag.
She went out, Masahiko said.
May I look at your computer?
Computer?
Chia stood, confused.
It is sandbenders, yes?
She poured some of the tea, which was still steaming.
Sure. You want tea?
No, Masahiko said.
I drink coffee only.
He squatted on the tatami beside the low table and ran an admiring fingertip along the edge of the sandbender's cast aluminum.
Beautiful. I have seen a small disc player by the same maker.
It is a cult, yes? A commune. Tribal people in Oregon.
The boy's black hair was long and glossy and smoothly brushed, but Chia saw there was a bit of noodle caught in it, the thin kinky kind that came in instant ramen bowls.
I'm sorry I was ported when Mitsuko came back. She'll think I was rude.
You are from Seattle.
Not a question.
You're her brother?
Yes.
Why are you here? His eyes large and dark, his face long and pale.
Your sister and I are both into low res.
You have come because he wants to marry Raithaway? Hot tea dribbled down Chia's chin.
She told you that?
Yes, Masahiko said. In Walled City, some people worked on her design. He was lost in his study of her sandbender, turning it over in his hand.
His fingers were long and pale, the nails badly chewed. Where's that?
Net side, he said, flipping the weight of his hair back over one shoulder.
What do they say about it?
Original concept, almost radical. He stroked the keys.
This is very beautiful.
You learned English here?
In Walled City. Chia tried another sip of tea, then put the cup down.
You have any coffee?
In my room, he said. Masahiko's room at the bottom of a short flight of concrete stairs to the rear of the restaurant's kitchen had probably been a storage closet. It was a boy nightmare, the sort of environment Chia knew from the brothers of friends. Its floor and ledge-like bed long vanished beneath unwashed clothes, ramen wrappers, Japanese magazines with wrinkled cover. A tower of empty foam ramen bowls in one corner, their hologram labels winking from beyond a single cone of halogen. A desk or table forming a second higher ledge cut from some recycled material that looked as though it had been laminated from shredded juice cartons. His computer there, a featureless black cube. A shallower shelf of the juice carton board supported a pale blue microwave, unopened ramen bowls, and half a dozen tiny steel cans of coffee. One of these, freshly microwaved, was hot in Chia's hand. The coffee was strong, sugary, thickly creamed. She sat beside him on the lumpy bed ledge, a padded jacket wadded up behind her for a cushion. It smelled faintly of boy, of ramen, and of coffee. Though he seemed very clean, now that she was this close, and she had a vague idea that Japanese people generally were. Didn't they love to bathe? The thought made her want a shower. I like this very much. Reaching to touch the sandbenders again, which he'd brought from upstairs and placed on the work surface in front of his black cube, sweeping aside a litter of plastic spoons, pens, nameless bits of metal and plastic.
How do you see to work yours?
Gesturing toward his computer with a miniature can of coffee. He said something in Japanese. Worms and dots of pastel neon lit the faces of the cube, crawling and pulsing, then died. The walls from floor to ceiling were thickly covered with successive layers of posters, handbills, graphics files. The wall directly in front of her, above and behind the black computer, was hung with a large scarf. A square of some silky material screened with a map or diagram in red and black and yellow. Hundreds of irregular blocks or rooms, units of some kind, pressing in around a central vacancy. An uneven vertical rectangle, black. Walled City, he said, following her eye. He leaned forward, fingertip finding a particular spot. This is mine, 8th level. Chia pointed to the center of the diagram.
What's this?
Black hole. In the original, something like an air shaft.
He looked at her.
Tokyo has a black hole, too. You have seen this?
No,
she said.
The palace.
No light. From a tall building at night, the Imperial Palace is a black hole.
Watching once, I saw a torch flare. What happened to it in the earthquake?
He raised his eyebrows. This, of course, would not be shown. All now is as before. We are assured of this. He smiled, but only with the corners of his mouth.
Where did Mitsuko go?
He shrugged.
Did she say when she'd be back?
No. She had thought of Hiromi Ogawa, and then of someone phoning for Kelsey's father. Hiromi? But then there was whatever it was. Upstairs in her bag in Mitsuko's room. She remembered Mary Alice yelling from behind the door to Eddie's office.
Zona had to be right. You know a club called Whiskey Clone?
No. He stroked the buffed aluminum edges of her sand fenders.
How about monkey boxing?
He looked at her, shook his head.
You probably don't get out much, do you?
He held her gaze. In Walled City.
I want to go to this club, monkey boxing. Except maybe it isn't called that anymore. It's in a place called Shinjuku. I was in the station there before.
Clubs are not open now.
That's okay. I just want you to show me where it is. Then I'll be able to find my own way back.
No. I must return to Walled City. I have responsibilities. Find the address of this place, and I will explain to your computer where to go. The Sandbenders could find its own way there. But Chia had decided she didn't want to go alone.
Better to go with a boy than Mitsuko, and Mitsuko's allegiance to her chapter could be a problem anyway.
Mainly, though, she just wanted to get out of here.
Zona's news had spooked her. Somebody knew she was here.
And
what to do about the thing in her bag? You like this, right?
Pointing at her sandbenders.
Yes, he said. The software's even better. I've got an emulator in there that'll install a virtual sandbenders in your computer. Take me to monkey boxing, and it's yours. Have you always lived here?
She asked as they walked to the station.
In this neighborhood, I mean?
Masahiko shrugged. Chia thought the street made him uncomfortable. Maybe just being outside. He'd traded his gray sweats for equally baggy black cotton pants, cinched at the ankle with elastic-sided black nylon gaiters above black leather work shoes. He still wore his black tunic, but with the addition of a short-billed black leather cap that she thought might have once been part of a school uniform. If the tunic was too big for him, the cap was too small. He wore it perched forward at an angle, the bill riding low.
I live in Walled City, he said.
Mitsuko told me. That's like a multi-user domain.
Walled City is unlike anything.
Give me the address when I give you the emulator. I'll check it out.
The sidewalk arched over a concrete channel running with grayish water.
It reminded her of Venice. She wondered if there had been a stream there once.
It has no address, he said.
That's impossible, Chia said. He said nothing.
She thought about what she'd found when she'd opened the SeaTac duty-free bag.
Something flat and rectangular, dark gray. Maybe made from one of those weird plastics that had metal in them. One end had rows of little holes. The other had complicated shapes, metal, and a different kind of plastic.
There didn't seem to be any way to open it. No visible seams, no markings. Didn't rattle when she shook it.
Maybe What Things Are, the icon dictionary, would recognize it. But she hadn't had time. Masahiko had been downstairs changing when she'd slit the blue and yellow plastic with Mitsuko's serially numbered commemorative low-res Swiss Army knife. She'd glanced around the room for a hiding place. Everything too neat and tidy. Finally, she'd put it back in her bag, hearing him coming up the stairs from the kitchen, which was where it was now, along with her sandbenders under her arm as they entered the station, which was probably not smart, but she just didn't know. She used Kelsey's cash card to buy them both tickets. Arlie.
There was a fax from Rydell waiting for Lainey when Blackwell dropped him at the hotel. It had been printed on expensive-looking gray letterhead that contrasted drastically with the body of the fax itself, which had been sent from a Lucky Dragon 24-hour convenience store on Sunset. The smiling Lucky Dragon, blowing smoke from its nostrils, was centered just below the hotel's silver-embossed logo, something Lainey thought of as the droopy evil elf hat. Whatever it was supposed to be, the hotel's decorators were very fond of it. It formed a repeating motif in the lobby, and Lainey was glad that it didn't seem to have reached the guest rooms yet. Rydell had hand-printed his fax with a medium-width fiber pen in scrupulously neat block capital. Lainey read it in the elevator. It was addressed to C. Lainey, guest. I think they know where you are. She and the day manager had coffee in the lobby, and he kept looking at me. He could have checked the phone log easy. Wish I hadn't called you there. Sorry. Anyway, then she and the others checked out, fast, left the techs to pack up. A tech called Genghis in the garage that some of them were on their way to Japan, and he was glad he wasn't. Watch out, okay? Rydell. Okay, Laney said, and remembered how he'd walked to the Lucky Dragon one night against Rydell's advice because he couldn't sleep. There were scary-looking bionic hookers posted every block or so, but otherwise it hadn't felt too dangerous. Someone had painted a memorial mural to J.D. Shapley on one side of the Lucky Dragon, and the management had had the good sense to leave it there, culturally integrating their store into the actual 24-hour life of the strip. You could buy a burrito there, a lottery ticket, batteries, tests for various diseases. You could do voicemail, email, send faxes. It had occurred to Laney that this was probably the only store for miles that sold anything that anyone ever really needed. The others all sold things that he couldn't even imagine wanting. He reread the fax, walking down the corridor, and used the card key to open his door. There was a shallow wicker basket on the bed, spread with white tissue and unfamiliar objects. On closer inspection, these proved to be his socks and underwear, freshly laundered and arranged in little paper holders embossed with the elf hat. He opened the narrow mirrored closet door, activating a built-in light, and discovered his shirts arranged on hangers, including the blue button-downs Kathy Torrance had made fun of. They looked brand new. He touched one of the lightly starched cuffs. "Stitch count," he said. He looked down at Rydell's folded fax. He imagined Kathy Torrance headed straight for him on an SST from Los Angeles. He discovered that he couldn't imagine her sleeping. He'd never seen her asleep, and somehow it didn't seem like something she'd willingly do. In the weird vibrationless quiet of supersonic flight, she'd be staring at the gray blank of the window or at the screen of her computer, thinking of him. The screen behind him came on with a soft chime, and he jumped 4 inches straight up. He turned and saw the BBC logo. Yamazaki's second video. He was a third of the way through it when the door chimed. Rez was strolling along a narrow trail in the jungle somewhere, wearing sun-bleached khakis and rope-soled sandals. He was singing something as he went, a wordless little melody over and over, trying different tones and stresses. His bare chest shone with sweat, and when the open shirt swung aside, you'd catch a corner of his I Ching tattoo. He had a length of bamboo and swung it as he walked, swatting at dangling vines. Laney had a sneaking suspicion that the wordless melody had subsequently turned into some global billion seller, but he couldn't place it yet. The door chimed again. He got up, crossed to the door, thumbed the speaker button. Yes? Hello? A woman's voice. He touched the card-sized screen set into the door frame and saw a dark-haired woman. Bang. The tech from the appliance warehouse. He unlocked the door and opened it. Yamazaki thinks we should talk, she said. Laney saw that she was wearing a black suit with a narrow skirt, dark stockings. Aren't you supposed to be shopping for a van? He stepped back to let her in. Got one, closing the door behind her. When the low-res machine decides to throw money at a problem, money will be thrown, usually in the wrong direction. She looked at the screen where Rez was still swinging along, swatting flies from his neck and chest, lost in composition. Homework? Yamazaki. Arlie McRae, she said, taking a card from a small black purse and handing it to him. Her name there, then 4 telephone numbers and 2 addresses, neither of them physical. Do you have a card, Mr. Laney? Colin, no, I don't. They can make them up for you at the desk. Everyone has a card here. He put the card in his shirt pocket. Blackwell didn't give me one. Neither did Yamazaki. Outside the low-res organization, I mean. It's like not having socks. I have socks, Laney said, indicating the basket on the bed. Do you feel like watching a BBC documentary on low-res?
No.
I don't think I can turn it off. He'll know.
Try lowering the volume, manually,
she demonstrated. A technician, Laney said.
With a van. An umpty million yen worth of equipment that didn't seem to do much for you.
She sat down in one of the room's 2 small armchairs, crossing her legs. Laney took the other chair. Not your fault. You got me in there just fine. But it's not the kind of data I can work with.
Yamazaki told me what you're supposed to be able to do, she said. I didn't believe him.
Laney looked at her. I can't help you there. There were three smiling suns, like black woodblock prints, down the inside of her left calf.
They're woven into the stocking. Catalan.
Lainey looked up. I hope you're not going to ask me to explain what it is people think they pay me to do, he said. Because I can't. I don't know.
Don't worry, she said. I just work here. But what I'm being paid to do right now is determine what it is we could give you that would allow you to do whatever it is that you're alleged to be able to do.
Lainey looked at the screen. Concert footage now. And Rez was dancing, a microphone in his hand. You've seen this video, right? Is he serious about that Sino-Celtic thing he was talking about in that interview?
You haven't met him yet, have you?
No.
It's not the easiest thing, deciding what Rez is serious about.
But how can there be Sino-Celtic mysticism when the Chinese and the Celts don't have any shared history?
Because Rez himself is half Chinese and half Irish. And if there's one thing he's serious about...
Yes?
It's Rez.
Lainey stared glumly at the screen as the singer was replaced by a close-up of Lowe's playing, his hands on the black-bodied guitar. Earlier, a venerable British guitarist in wonderful tweed had opined as how they hadn't really expected the next Hendrix to emerge from Taiwanese canto pop. But then again, they hadn't actually been expecting the first one, had they?
Yamazaki told me the story. What happened to you?
Arlie McRae said.
Up to a certain point.
Lainey closed his eyes.
The show never aired, Lainey. Out of Control dropped it. What happened?
He'd taken to having breakfast beside the chateau's small oval pool, past the homely clabbered bungalows that Rydell said were a later addition. It was the one time of the day that felt like his own. Or did, until Rice Daniels arrived, which was usually toward the bottom of a 3-cup pot of coffee, just prior to his eggs and bacon. Daniels would cross the terracotta to Lainey's table with what could only be described as a spring in his step. Lainey privately wished to ascribe this to drug use, of which he'd seen no evidence whatever, and indeed Daniels's most potent public indulgence seemed to be multiple cups of decaf espresso taken with curls of lemon peel. He favored loosely woven beige suits and collarless shirts. This particular morning, however, Daniels had not been alone. And Lainey had detected a lack of temper in the accustomed spring. A certain jangled brittleness there, and the painful-looking glasses seemed to grip his head even more tightly than usual. Beside him came a gray-haired man in a dark brown suit of Western cut, hawk-faced and wind-burnt, the blade of his impressive nose protruding from a huge black pair of sunglasses. He wore black alligator roping boots and carried a dusty-looking briefcase of age-darkened tan cowhide, its handle mended with what Lainey supposed had to be baling wire. Lainey, Rice Daniels had said, arriving at the table, this is Aaron Pursley.
Don't get up, son,
Pursley said, though Lainey hadn't thought to.
Fellas is bringing you your breakfast.
One of the Mongolian waiters was crossing with a tray from the direction of the bungalows. Pursley put his battle-scarred briefcase down and took one of the white-painted metal chairs. The waiter served Lainey's eggs. Lainey signed for them, adding a 15% tip. Pursley was flipping through the contents of his case. He wore half a dozen heavy silver rings on the fingers of either hand, some of them studded with turquoise. Lainey couldn't remember when he'd last seen anyone carry around that much paper.
You're the lawyer, Lainey said. On television. In the flesh as well, son.
Pursley was on Cops in Trouble. And before that, he'd been famous for defending celebrity clients. Daniels hadn't taken a seat, and stood behind Pursley now with a hunched, uncharacteristic posture, hands in his trouser pocket.
Here we are, Pursley said.
He drew out a sheaf of blue paper.
Don't let your eggs get cold.
Have a seat, Lainey said to Daniels. Daniels winced behind his glasses.
Now, Pursley said. You were in a federal orphanage in Gainesville, it says here, from age 12 to age 17.
Lainey looked at his eggs.
That's right. During that time, you participated in a number of drug trials. You were an experimental subject?
Yes, Lainey said.
his eggs looking somehow farther away, or like a picture in a magazine.
This was voluntary on your part?
There were rewards.
Voluntary,
Pursley said.
You get on any of that 5SB?
They didn't tell us what they were giving us, Laney said. Sometimes we'd get a placebo instead.
You don't mistake 5SB for any placebo, son, but I think you know that.
Which was true, but Laney just sat there.
Well?
Pursley removed his big, heavy glasses. His eyes were cold and blue and set into an intricate topography of wrinkles. I probably had it, Laney said. Pursley slapped the blue papers on his thigh.
Well, there you are. You almost certainly did. Now, do you know how that substance eventually affected many of the test subjects?
Daniels unclamped his glasses and began to knead the bridge of his nose. His eyes were closed.
Stuff tends to turn males into fixated homicidal stalkers, Pursley said,
putting his glasses back on and stuffing the papers into his case.
Comes on years later sometime. Go after media faces, politicians. That's why it's now one of the most illegal substances in a damn country you care to look. Drug that makes folks want to stalk and kill politicians, well, boy, it'll get to be.
He grinned dryly.
I'm not one, Laney said. I'm not like that.
Daniels opened his eyes. It doesn't matter, he said. What matters is that SlitScan can counter all our material by raising the possibility, the merest shadow, however remote, that you are.
You see, son, Pursley said, they just make out you got into your line of work because you were predisposed to that, spying on famous people. You didn't tell them about any of it, did you?
No, Laney said. I didn't.
There you go,
said Pursley.
They'll say they hired you because you were good at it, but you just got too damn good at it.
But she wasn't famous, Laney said.
But he is, Rice Daniels said, and they'll say you were after him. They'll say the whole thing was your idea. They'll wring their hands about responsibility. They'll talk about their new screening procedures for quantitative analysts. And nobody, Laney, nobody at all, will be watching us.
That's about the size of it, Pursley said, standing.
He picked up the briefcase.
That real bacon there, like off a hog.
They say it is, Laney said.
Damn, Pursley said. These Hollywood hotels are fast lane.
He stuck out his hand. Laney shook it.
Nice meeting you, son.
Daniels didn't even bother to say goodbye. And 2 days later, going over the printout of his charges, Laney would notice that it all began, the billing in his own name, with a large pot of coffee, scrambled eggs and bacon, and a 15% tip. Arlie McRae was staring at him. Do they know that? She asked. Does Blackwell?
No,
Laney said. Not that part, anyway. He could see Rydell's fax folded on the bedside stand. They didn't know about that, either. What happened then? What did you do?
I found out I was paying for at least some of the lawyers they'd gotten for me. I didn't know what to do. I sat out there by the pool a lot. It was sort of pleasant, actually.
I wasn't thinking about anything in particular. Know what I mean? Maybe, she said.
Then I heard about this job from one of the security people at the hotel.
She slowly shook her head.
What?
He said. Never mind, she said. You make about as much sense as the rest of it. Probably you'll fit right in.
Into what? She looked at her watch.
Black-faced stainless on a plain black nylon band. Dinner's at 8, but Rez will be late. Come out for a walk and a drink. I'll try to tell you what I know about it.
If you want to, Laney said.
They're paying me to do it, she said, getting up. And it probably beats wrestling large pieces of high-end electronics up and down escalators.
20. Monkey boxing.
Between stations, there was a gray shudder beyond the windows of the silent train. Not as of surfaces rushing past, but as if particulate matter were being vibrated there at some crucial rate just prior to the emergence of a new order of being. Chia and Masahiko had found two seats between a trio of plaid-skirted schoolgirls and a businessman who was reading a fat Japanese comic. There was a woman on the cover with her breasts bound up like balls of twine, but conically, the nipples protruding like the popping eyes of a cartoon victim. Chia noticed that the artist had devoted much more time to drawing the twine, exactly how it was wrapped and knotted, than to drawing the breasts themselves. The woman had sweat running down her face and was trying to back away from someone or something cut off by the edge of the cover. Masahiko undid the top two buttons of his tunic and withdrew a 6-inch square of something black and rigid, no thicker than a pane of glass. He brushed it purposefully with the fingers of his right hand, beaded lines of colored light appearing at his touch. Though these were fainter here, washed out by the train's directionless fluorescence, Chia recognized the square as the control face of the computer she'd seen in his room. He studied the display, stroked it again, and frowned at the result. "Someone pays attention to my address," he said, "and to Mitsuko's."
"The restaurant?"
"Our user addresses."
"What kind of attention?"
"I do not know. We are not linked. Except by me." "Tell me about sandbenders," Masahiko said, putting the control face away and buttoning his tunic.
"It started with a woman who was an interface designer," Chia said, glad to change the subject. "Her husband was a jeweler, and he died of that nerve attenuation thing before they saw how to fix it. But he'd been a big green, too, and he hated the way consumer electronics were made, a couple of little chips and boards inside these plastic shells. The shells were just point-of-purchase eye candy," he said, "made to wind up in the landfill if nobody recycled it, and usually nobody did. So before he got sick, he used to tear up her hardware, the designers, and put the real parts into cases he'd make in his shop. Say he'd make a solid bronze case for a mini-disc unit, ebony inlays, carve the control surfaces out of fossil ivory, turquoise, rock crystal. It weighed more, sure, but it turned out a lot of people liked that. Like they had their music or their memory, whatever, in something that felt like it was there. And people like touching all that stuff. Metal, a smooth stone. And once you had the case, when the manufacturer brought out a new model, well, if the electronics were any better, you just pulled the old ones out and put the new ones in your case. So you still had the same object, just with better function."
Masahiko's eyes were closed, and he seemed to be nodding slightly, though perhaps only with the motion of the train.
"And it turned out some people liked that, too, liked it a lot. He started getting commissions to make these things. One of the first was for a keyboard, and the keys were cut from the keys of an old piano with the numbers and letters in silver. But then he got sick."
Masahiko's eyes opened, and she saw that not only had he been listening, but that he was impatient for more.
"So after he was dead, the software designer started thinking about all that and how she wanted to do something that took what he'd been doing into something else. So she cashed out her stock in all the companies she'd worked for, and she bought some land on the coast in Oregon."
And the train pulled into Shinjuku, and everyone stood up heading for the doors, the businessman closing his breast bondage comic and tucking it beneath his arm. Chia was leaning back to look at the strangest building she'd ever seen. It was shaped like the old-fashioned idea of a robot, a simplified human figure, its legs and upraised arms made of transparent plastic over a framework of metal. Its torso appeared to be of brick, in red, yellow, and blue, arranged in simple patterns. Escalators, stairways, and looping slides twisted through the hollow limbs, and puffs of white smoke emerged at regular intervals from the rectangular mouth of the thing's enormous face. Beyond it, the sky all gray and pressing down. "Tetsujin building," Masahiko said. "Monkey boxing was not there."
"What is it?"
"Osaka Tin Toy Institute," he said. "Monkey boxing this way." He was consulting the swarming squiggles on his control face. He pointed along the street, past a fast food franchise called California Reich. Its trademark, a stylized stainless steel palm tree against one of those twisted cross things like the meshbacks had drawn on their hands in her class on European history, which had pissed the teacher off totally, but Chia couldn't remember them drawing any palm trees.
Then two of them had gotten into a fight over which way you were supposed to draw the twisted parts on the cross, pointing left or pointing right, and one of them had zapped the other with a stun gun, the kind they were always making out of those disposable flash cameras, and the teacher had to call the police.
Ninth floor. Wet Leaves Fortune Building, he said.
He set off down the crowded pavement. Chia followed, wondering how long jet lag lasted, and how you were supposed to separate it from just being tired. Maybe what she was feeling now was what her civics program at her last school had called culture shock. She felt like everything, every little detail of Tokyo was just different enough to create a kind of pressure, something that built up against her eyes, as though they'd grown tired of having to notice all the differences. A little sidewalk tree that was dressed up in a sort of woven basketwork jacket, the neon avocado color of a payphone, a serious-looking girl with round glasses and a gray sweatshirt that said, Free Vagina. She'd been keeping her eyes extra wide to take all these things in, like they'd be processed eventually, but now her eyes were tired, and the differences were starting to back up. At the same time, she felt that if she squinted, maybe just the right way, she could make all this turn back into Seattle, some downtown part she'd walked through with her mother. Homesick. The strap of her bag digging into her shoulder each time her left foot came down. Masahiko turned a corner. There didn't seem to be alleys in Tokyo, not in the sense that there were smaller streets behind the big streets, the places where they put out the garbage, and there weren't any stores. There were smaller streets and smaller ones behind those, but you couldn't guess what you'd find there. A shoe repair place, an expensive-looking hair salon, a chocolate maker, a magazine stand where she noticed a copy of that same creepy comic with the woman all wrapped up like that. Another corner and they were back on what she took to be a main street. Cars here, anyway. She watched one turn into a street-level opening and vanish. Her scalp prickled. What if that were the way up to Eddie's club? That whiskey clone. That was right around here, wasn't it? How big was this Shinjuku place, anyway? What if the Graceland pulled up beside her? What if Eddie and Mary Alice were out looking for her? They were passing the opening the car had disappeared into. She looked in and saw that it was a kind of gas station. Where is it? She asked. Wet Leaves Fortune, he said, pointing up. Tall and narrow, square signs jutting out at the corners of each floor. It looked like almost all the others, but she thought Eddie's had been bigger. How do we get up there? He led her into a kind of lobby, a ground-floor arcade lined with tiny stall-like shops. Too many lights, mirrors, things for sale, all blurring together. Into a cramped elevator that smelled of stale smoke. He said something in Japanese and the door closed. The elevator sang them a little song, to tinkling music. Masahiko looked irritated. At the ninth floor, the door opened on a dust-covered man with a black headband sagging over his eyes. He looked at Chia. If you're the one from the magazine, he said, you're 3 days early. He pulled the headband off and wiped his face with it. Chia wasn't sure if he was Japanese or not, or what age he might be. His eyes were brown, spectacularly bloodshot under deep brows, and his black hair, pulled straight back and secured by the band, was streaked with gray. Behind him there was a constant banging and confusion, men yelling in Japanese. Someone pushing a high-sided orange plastic cart crammed with folded plaster-flecked cable, shards of plastic painted with gold gilt and Chinese red, part of a suspended ceiling let go with a twanging of wires, crashed to the floor. More cries. I'm looking for monkey boxing, Chia said.
Darling, the man said, you're a bit late.
He wore a black paper coverall, its sleeves torn off at the elbows, revealing arms tracked with blobby blue lines and circles. Some kind of faux primitive decoration. He wiped his eyes and squinted at her.
You aren't from the magazine in London?
No, Chia said.
No,
he agreed.
You seem a bit young even for them.
This is monkey boxing? Another section of ceiling came down. The dusty man squinted at her.
Where did you say you were from?
Seattle.
You heard about monkey boxing in Seattle?
Yes. He smiled wanly.
That's fun.
Heard about it in Seattle. You're on the club scene yourself, dear?
I'm Chia McKenzie.
Jun. I'm called Jun, dear. Owner, designer, DJ. But you're too late. Sorry. All that's left of monkey boxing's going out in these gomi carts. Landfill now, like every other broken dream. Had a lovely run while it lasted, better part of 3 months. You heard about our Shaolin Temple theme? That whole warrior monk thing? He sighed extravagantly. It was heaven. Every instant of it. The Okinawan bartenders shaved their heads after the first 3 nights and started to wear the orange robes. I surpassed myself in the booth. It was a vision, you understand? But that's the nature of the floating world, isn't it? We are in the water trade, after all, and one tries to be philosophical. But who is your friend here? I like his hair.
Masahiko Mimura, Chia said.
I like that black-clad boho butch bedsit thing, the man said. Mishiman Dietrich on the same half shell if it's done right.
Masahiko frowned. If monkey boxing is gone, Chia said, what will you do now?
Jun retied his headband. He looked less pleased.
Another club, but I won't be designing. They'll say I've sold out. Suppose I have. I'll still be managing the space, very nice salary, and an apartment along with it. But the concept...
He shrugged.
Were you here the night Rez told him he wanted to marry the Idoru?
His brow creased behind the headband.
I had to sign agreements,
he said.
You aren't from the magazine?
No.
If he hadn't come in that night, I suppose we might still be up and running. And really, he wasn't the sort of thing we'd tried to be about. We had Maria Paz just after she'd split up with her boyfriend, the public relations monster, and the press were thick as flies. She's huge here, did you know that? And we'd had Blue Ahmed from Chrome Koran, and the press scarcely noticed. Rez and his friends, though, press was not a problem. Sent in this big minder who looked as though he'd been using his face as a chopping block. Came up to me and said Rez had heard about the place and was about to drop in with a few friends, and could we arrange a table with a bit of privacy? Well, really, I had to think. Rez, who? Then it clicked, of course, and I said, fine, absolutely. And we put 3 tables together in the back, and even borrowed a purple cordon from the Gumi boys in the hostess place upstairs.
And he came? Rez?
Absolutely. An hour later, there he is, smiling, shaking hands. Signing things, if you asked him to, though there wasn't too burning a demand, actually. 4 women with him, 2 other men, if you didn't count the minder. Very nice black suit. Yoji. Bit the worse for wear. Rez, I mean. Been out to dinner, it looked like. Had a few drinks with it. Certain amount of laughter, if you follow me.
He turned and said something to one of the workmen, who wore shoes like 2-toed black leather socks. Chia, who had no idea what monkey boxing had actually been about, imagined Rez at a table with some other people, behind a purple rope, and in the foreground a crowd of Japanese people doing whatever Japanese people did at a club like that. Dancing?
Then our boy gets up. He's going to the toilet. The big minder makes as if he's getting up to go too, but our boy waves him back. Big laugh from the table. Big minder not too happy. 2 of the women start to get up like they're going with him. He'll have none of it. Waves them back. More laughter. Not that anyone else was paying him that much attention. I was going into the booth in 5 minutes with a set of extremely raw North African. Had to judge the crowd, get on it with them, know just when to drop it in. But there he went, right through them, and only 1 or 2 even noticed, and they didn't stop dancing.
What kind of club was it?
Where nobody would stop dancing for Rez.
So I was thinking about my set, the order of it. And suddenly he's right in front of me. Big grin. Eyes funny, though I wouldn't swear it was anything he'd done in the toilet, if you know what I mean.
Chia nodded her head. What did he mean?
And would I mind, he said, hand on my shoulder, if he just spoke briefly to the crowd. said he'd been thinking about something for a long time, and now he'd made up his mind, and he wanted to tell people. And the big minder just materialized there, wanting to know, was there any problem? None at all, Rez says, giving my shoulder a squeeze, but he was just going to have a word with the crowd.
Chia looked at Jun's shoulder, wondering which one had been squeezed by Rez's actual hand.
So he did, Jun said.
But what did he say? She asked.
A load of bollocks, dear. Evolution and technology and passion. Man's need to find beauty in the emerging order. His own burning need to get his end in with some software dolly wank toy. Ball. Utter.
He pushed his headband up with his thumb, but it fell back.
And because he did that, opened his mouth up in my club, low slash bloody Rez bought my club. Bought me as well, and I've signed agreements that I won't talk to any of you about any of that. And now, if you and your charming friend will excuse me, darling, I have work to do.
21. Standover Man. There was a man on stilts at the intersection nearest the hotel. He wore a hooded white paper suit, a gas mask, and a pair of rectangular signboards. Messages scrolled down the boards in Japanese as he shifted his weight to maintain balance. Streams of pedestrian traffic flowed around and past him. What's that? Laney asked, indicating the man on stilts.
A sect,
Arlie McRae said.
New logic. They say the world will end when the combined weight of all the human nervous tissue on the planet reaches a specific figure.
A very long multi-digit number went scrolling down.
Is that it? Laney asked.
No, she said. That's their latest estimate of the current total weight.
She'd gone back to her room for the black coat she now wore, leaving Laney to change into clean socks, underwear, a blue shirt. He didn't have a tie, so he'd buttoned the shirt at the collar and put his jacket back on. He'd wondered if everyone who worked for Lo-Rez stayed in that same hotel. Laney saw the man's eyes through the transparent visor as they passed, a look of grim patience. The stilts were the kind workers wore to put up ceilings, articulated alloy sprung with steel.
What's supposed to happen when there's enough nervous tissue?
A new order of being. They don't talk about it. Rez was interested in them, apparently. He tried to arrange an audience with the founder.
And?
The founder declined. He said that Rez made his living through the manipulation of human nervous tissue, and that made him untouchable.
Rez was unhappy?
Not according to Blackwell. Blackwell said it seemed to cheer him up a little.
He's not cheerful ordinarily.
Laney sidestepped to avoid a bicycle someone was wheeling in the opposite direction.
Let's say that the things that bother Rez aren't the things that bother most people.
Laney noticed a dark green van edging along beside them. Its wraparound windows were mirrored, its neon license plates framed with animated tubes of mini Vegas twinklers.
I think we're being followed, he said.
We'd better be. I wanted the kind with the weird chrome curb feelers that make them look like silverfish, but I had to settle for custom license plate trim. Where you go, it goes. And parking around here is probably more of a challenge than anything you'll be expected to do tonight.
Now, she said, down here.
Steep, narrow stairs, walled with an alarming pink mosaic of glistening, tonsil-like nodules. Laney hesitated, then saw a sign.
The letters made up of hundreds of tiny pastel oblongs. Le Chicle. Stepping down, he lost sight of the van. A chewing gum theme bar, he thought. And then, I'm getting too used to this.
But he still avoided touching the wall of chewed gum as he followed her down.
Into powdery pinks and grays. But these impersonating the unchewed product, wall-wide slabs of it, hung with archaic signage from the nation of his birth, screen-printed steel, framed and ancient cardboard, cunningly lit, icons of gum. Bazooka Joe featured centrally, a figure unknown to Laney, but surely no more displaced.
Come here often? Laney asked, as they took stools with bulbous cushions in a particularly lurid bubblegum pink.
The bar was laminated with thousands of rectangular chewing gum wrappers.
Yes, she said.
but mainly because it's unpopular, and it's non-smoking, which is still kind of special here.
What's black black? Laney asked,
looking at a framed poster depicting a stylized 1940s automobile hurtling through the faint suggestion of city street. Aside from black black, it was lettered in a sort of Art Deco Japanese. Come, you can still buy it, she said. The cab drivers all chew it. Lots of caffeine.
In gum?
They sell pick-me-ups here full of liquid nicotine.
I think I'll have a beer instead.
When the waitress, in tiny silver shorts and a prehensile pink angora top, had taken their orders, Arlie opened her purse and removed a notebook. These are linear topographies of some of the structures you accessed earlier today. She passed Laney the notebook. They're in a format called Realtree 7.2.
Laney clicked through a series of images, abstract geometrics arranged in vanishing linear perspective. I don't know how to read them, he said.
She poured her sake. You really were trained by Dad America?
I was trained by a bunch of Frenchmen who like to play tennis.
Realtree's from Dad America, the best quantitative analysis software they've got.
She closed the notebook, put it back in her purse.
Laney poured his beer.
Ever hear of something called TIDAL?
TIDAL?
Acronym, maybe.
No. She lifted the china cup and blew, like a child cooling tea.
It was another Dad America tool, or the start of one. I don't think it reached the market. But that was how I learned to find the nodal point.
Okay, she said. What are the nodal points?
Laney looked at the bubbles on the surface of his beer. It's like seeing things in clouds, Laney said, except the things you see are really there.
She put her sake down. Yamazaki promised me you weren't crazy.
It's not crazy. It's something to do with how I process low-level broad-spectrum input, something to do with pattern recognition.
And SlitScan hired you on the basis of that?
They hired me when I demonstrated that it works. But I can't do that with the kind of data you showed me today.
Why not?
Laney raised his beer. Because it's like trying to have a drink with a bank. It's not a person. It doesn't drink. There's no place for it to sit.
He drank.
Rez doesn't generate patterns I can read, because everything he does is at one remove. It's like looking in an annual report for the personal habits of the chairman of the board. It's not going to be there. From the outside, it just looks like that Realtree stuff. If I enter a specific area, I don't get any sense of how the data there relates to the rest of it. See? It's got to be relational. He drummed his fingers on the laminated gum wrappers.
Somewhere in Ireland.
Guest house with a beach view. Nobody there. Records of how it was kept stocked. Stuff for the bathroom, toothpaste, shaving foam.
I've been there, she said. That's on an estate he bought from an older musician, an Irishman. It's beautiful, like Italy in a way.
You think he'll take this Idaroo back there when they get hitched?
Nobody has any idea what he's talking about when he says he wants to marry her.
Then an apartment in Stockholm. Huge, great big stoves in each room made of glazed ceramic bricks.
I don't know that one. He has places all over, and some of them are kept very quiet. There's another country place in the south of France, a house in London, apartments in New York, Paris, Barcelona. I was working out of the Catalan office, reformatting all their stuff, and Spain's as well, when this Idaroo thing hit. I've been here ever since.
But you know him?
You knew him before. He's the navel of the world I work in, Laney. That has a way of making people unknowable.
What about Low?
Quiet. Very. Bright. Very. She frowned at her sake. I don't think any of it's ever really gotten to Low. He seems to regard their entire career as some freak event unrelated to anything else.
Including his partner deciding to marry a software agent?
Lo told me a story once about a job he'd had. He worked for a soup vendor in Hong Kong, a wagon on the sidewalk. He said the wagon had been in business for over 50 years, and their secret was that they'd never cleaned the kettle. In fact, they'd never stopped cooking the soup. It was the same seafood soup they'd been selling for 50 years, but it was never the same, because they added fresh ingredients every day, depending on what was available. He said that was what his career as musician felt like, and he liked that about it. Blackwell says if Rez were more like Lowe, he'd still be in prison.
Why?
Blackwell was serving a 9-year sentence in an Australian maximum security prison when Rez talked his way in to give a concert. Just Rez. Lowe and the others thought it was too dangerous. They'd been warned that it could turn into a hostage-taking situation. The prison authorities refused to take any responsibility, and they wanted it in writing. Rez signed anything they put in front of him. His security people resigned on the spot. He went in with 2 guitars, a wireless mic, and a very basic amplification system. During the concert, a riot broke out. Apparently, it was orchestrated by a group of Italian prisoners from Melbourne. 5 of them took Rez into the prison laundry, which they'd chosen because it was windowless and easily defended. They informed Rez they were going to kill him if they couldn't negotiate their release in exchange for his. They discussed cutting off at least one of his fingers to demonstrate that they meant business, or possibly some more intimate part, though that may simply have been to make him more anxious. Which it did. She signaled the pink Angora waitress for more sake. Blackwell, who'd evidently been extremely irritated at the interruption of the concert, which he'd been enjoying enormously, appeared in the laundry approximately 40 minutes after Rez was taken prisoner. Neither Rez nor the Italians saw him arrive, and the Italians definitely hadn't been expecting him. She paused. He killed 3 of them with a tomahawk. Put the end of it into their heads. 1, 2, 3, Rez says, like that. No fuss, whatever.
A tomahawk?
Sort of narrow-bladed hatchet with a spike opposite the blade. Extends the reach, imparts terrific force, and with practice can be thrown with considerable accuracy. Blackwell swears by it. The other 2 fled, although they both seem to have died in the aftermath of the riot. Personally, I'm sure Blackwell or his mates killed them, because he was never charged with the murder of the other 3. The sole surviving witness was Rez, whom Blackwell escorted to the barricade the guards had erected in the exercise yard. Her sake arrived. It took Rez's lawyers 3 months to get Blackwell's sentence reversed on a technicality. They've been together ever since.
What was Blackwell in for?
Murder, she said. Do you know what a standover man is?
No.
It's a peculiarly Australian concept. I'm tempted to think it could only have grown out of a culture comprised initially of convicts, but my Australian friends don't buy that. The standover man is a loner, a predator who preys on other, more prosperous criminals, often extremely dangerous ones. He captures them and stands over them to extort money.
What's that mean?
He tortures them until they tell him where their money is. And these are often fairly serious operators with people paid to take care of them, specifically to prevent this sort of thing. Tortures them. Toe cutter is a related term. When they tell him what he needs to know, he kills them.
And Blackwell was suddenly and noiselessly and simply there, very black and matte, in an enormous waxed cotton drover's coat.
Behind him, the faded American advertising and the grays and pinks of gum, his fretted scalp concealed by the waxed cotton crown of a broad black hat. Ollie, dear, you wouldn't take the name in vain, would you?
But he smiled at her.
I'm explaining your earlier career to Mr. Laney, Blackwell. I'd only just gotten up to the massage parlor, and now you've ruined it.
Never mind.
Dinner's been moved up at the request of his Rosa. I'm here to take you. Change of venue as well. Hope you don't mind. Where? Arlie said, as if not yet prepared to move.
The Western world, said Blackwell.
And me in my good shoes, she said.
End of side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over.